From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Today marks the 75th anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, which came on the morning of December 7th, 1941, a day then-President Franklin Delano Roosevelt decreed would live in infamy. There are still some living witnesses to the attack, some who now call Southwest Florida home. They were teenagers when they survived the bombing of Pearl Harbor.
The boat goes up, comes down, but I didn't come down on the boat. I come down in burning oil and water. Burned my clothes, and I was getting scorched.
Today we'll hear their stories and the stories from people inspired to join the war effort by this historic event. Plus, from British airmen learning to fly at Florida airfields to target practice on the Barrier Islands, a historian tells us about Florida's pivotal role in World War II. First, the news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Today is the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor, the Japanese attack on our Hawaiian naval base on the morning of this day back in 1941. More than 350 planes were launched from aircraft carriers of the Imperial Japanese Navy. All eight of the U.S. Navy's battleships were damaged. Four sank, two were completely destroyed, including the USS Arizona and USS Oklahoma. More than 2,400 people died in that attack, which eventually drew the United States into World War II. Today on our show, we'll hear from Pearl Harbor survivors and others who served in World War II, either in combat or working on the home front, who now call Southwest Florida home. And we'll look at the role Florida played in the war effort and how this war shaped the state that we know today. We are remembering Pearl Harbor today, the 75th anniversary of the attack. Maybe you or a family member was there. Call in to Gulf Coast Live and share your story. Call 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. You can also reach out on Facebook, WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU. Tweet us at the hashtag GCL. We'll hear from many voices telling their stories about Pearl Harbor, but joining us here in the studio is Dr. Lois Bolin, a historian who has worked with the Spirit of 45 in Naples and nationally. That's an organization dedicated to preserving the legacy of the men and women of America's World War II generation. Welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Bolin, you say that the Second World War marked the emergence of a modern Florida. Before we hear from some of our Pearl Harbor survivors, I wanted to ask you to paint a picture for us of what Florida was like in 1941.
Well, when you think about especially Southwest Florida, it really was Florida's final frontier. So we'd had World War II, and the Tamiami Trail had been completed, but so there still wasn't a lot of activity in this area. So when Pearl Harbor struck, there were like eight training bases in the area. By the end of 1945, there were over 200, which meant a huge influx of people coming into this area and a lot of training for flying. And these flyboys, when they saw the area, they said, "We're coming back here because it's beautiful." And that's what they did. They came back and they created the boom for Florida. A lot of the airports stayed, as well as some of the other training bases and so forth. And they basically created the modern middle class that we see today, that created the boom in Florida.
The post-war,
yes,
middle class expansion.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a time when people were not afraid to get out of the cities. And that's where people were kind of motivating outwards. So being in a more rural area like this made sense?
Well, it was a paradise. After you'd been through the war, being maybe in a hustling and bustling city was not really the thing they wanted to do, because they had seen the peace that was here. They saw the sunshine. It was a way to get away. And also the land was a lot cheaper, you know, coming back to start your new family or maybe saving up for that second home or that Cadillac. They had a vision. After the war was over, they had a vision for a new America and a new kind of prosperity. And Florida was the place to come and do that.
It did mark a time of serious change, but that all began on this day back in 1941. Let's hear from one of the Pearl Harbor survivors who now lives here in Southwest Florida. We went to the North Fort Myers home of John E. Gideon. He's 96 years old now. Born in Seattle, Washington on April 28th in 1920, he was raised in Los Angeles. And at 21 years of age, he joined the Navy. That was in June of 1941. Just 6 months later, in December of that same year, he was between ships with the Navy and was learning to drive a motor launch at the naval base in what was then the territory of Hawaii. Here is Mr. Gideon's memory from that day.
Come December the 7th, I got up about 7 o'clock, I guess. I was just getting down and got on my motor launch, just about the time when the torpedoes ship was coming in. If I had had something to shot, I could have shot the Japs right out of their cockpit. They were as close as maybe 50, 60 feet away. That happened real fast. Those planes come in fast. And then the bombers, the high bombers come in. That's when I was overtaken. The sailors that were blown off the ship in the fiery water. The boat got into the water to get them out, but most of them had died. Most of them were dead. My main place was over by Battleship Row. We start taking fellas out of the water. So then I come back in, and I went several trips like that. I hauled water and medicine. And then I took the motor launch back to my dock, 1010 dock. O'Day asked me if I would be an engineer on a captain's gig. So I got on it. So we got out, and we got over by the Oklahoma. And I come up, just as I got up on deck, a bomb come down. I'm pretty sure it was the one that hit the Oklahoma, because it was in that area. The boat goes up, comes down, but I didn't come down on the boat. I come down in burning oil and water. Burned my clothes, and I was getting scorched. I hollered at these guys, you know, to come up. No, they wouldn't get up there. Nobody helped me, but I grabbed a hold of one of the gobble hooks on it. I was able to climb up. I don't know where the energy come from. And I had taken my clothes all off. They were burning on fire. So I was stark naked. Now, about this time, all the bombing was done. All the ships were bombed. They were leaning over. The Oklahoma was all turned over. You could hear in the Oklahoma, men who had japped inside the boat were sitting on the hull of the boat there. I was there when the Arizona blew up. Boy, that was something. When it blew up, I mean, I thought the whole island was going to blow up when it went off. And then, of course, it affected the next ship to it. I didn't have any fear. I'm not the type to really... I think more of what I have to do or should do. I guess I was dumbfounded because I don't feel any fear. It's hard to believe what happened.
Despite being injured during the attack on Pearl Harbor, Gideon says he was never awarded a Purple Heart. When he left the military, he went on to college and earned a degree in mechanical engineering. He spent his career as a mechanical engineer, including research and development on the Polaris missile, a submarine-launched nuclear missile developed during the Cold War. He has two daughters, five grandkids, and several great-grandkids. Dr. Boland, hearing these firsthand accounts like this is just, it's really riveting. It seems like every year, we are that much further removed and almost desensitized to what this attack was and what it meant for the men that were there. How did the news of Pearl Harbor get to Florida? What amounts of news got here as far as vivid descriptions like that? And what were the most immediate impacts?
Well, like everybody else around the country, it first came across the radio. Then it hit the newspaper. And I'm sure... within Florida, it was like any other place. It was shock. It was unbelievable. We just finished World War I, and we were totally not willing to get into any other war. But by that December the 8th, the country had turned around because we'd been attacked on our soil, or close to our ships were attacked in Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. So it was like any other thing. It was shock, and it was just a paradigm shift to we have to strike back, and we're going to be a part of it.
Information flow at that time was incredibly different from the scene that we have right now. I mean, if you talk to a 20, 25-year-old right now about information, you had to be sitting in front of a radio to get the information, and the kind of information you got was different. There wasn't video, and if there was, it was not in color. It was just a completely different communication
module. Totally different. It was, like you said, you had to be on the radio. Someone neighbor had to tell a neighbor. Someone had to write out if you lived in the country to let you know. It was an entirely different kind of – and that's a lot why the children can't maybe relate to it, because it's hard to think since they grew up with computers and social media and so forth that – But it didn't take long for the word to spread because people began signing up immediately.
People were definitely interested in it, and we're interested in hearing your stories. Today is the 75th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. Maybe you or a family member was there. Call in to Gulf Coast Live and share your story. We're at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. You can also reach out on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU. Tweet us using the hashtag GCL. We were also able to visit with another Pearl Harbor survivor here in Southwest Florida, Don Thomas, who is now 93. He grew up in the small southeastern Kansas town of Independence, named for the Declaration of Independence. At 17, he joined the Navy. By the time he was through with basic training in October, he had turned 18. He was then sent to San Diego, where he boarded the USS Enterprise, which took him to the base in Hawaii, where he was then stationed on USS Oklahoma.
Donald H. Thomas, well, I'm 93. Navy sounded like a good deal to me. I went in at 17. I turned 18 in October of 41. We were through with basic training and went to San Diego, California. I took the USS Enterprise aircraft carrier to Pearl Harbor and went aboard the Oklahoma. On December 7th, we had to work. We were getting ready for the inspection by the Navy Secretary Knox on Monday. And, of course, notified then over the speaker that this was no test, that we were being attacked. We heard the first loud explosion on the ship, and we all manned our battle stations, which, as I said, were below deck. We heard two more explosions, and the ship started to list. We decided that we couldn't do much good where we were at, so we started topside. Of those pilots coming in that I could see when I got up to topside there, we had intensive training about the different Japanese planes long before Pearl Harbor, and so we knew what they were. There was no question about being attacked, and communications were pretty poor in those times. We didn't know what was happening afterwards, you know. Everybody was doing what they could to help everybody else. We were scared. We had no weapons at all. We didn't know what we were going to do then, if the Japanese were actually going to land or a landing party or something like that. We were unprepared for what we might have to do, you know. So we went down, eventually picked up by one of the longboats from our ship to Ford Island. We helped people swimming in. They were all covered with oil. Families of the naval officers that came out to also help. As they came up, one guy was really burned bad on one side. So we stayed there for quite some time. The next day, we went along the line of the battleships left there. We helped do some cleaning up there, and we saw some more gruesome things that I'd never seen before. And those bombs that hit our wood decks caused the splinters from the wood there to make some bad weapons. So we worked pretty much the whole day just helping out as much as we could with the ships in line left there. And even there was still some fires burning at that time. That day, December 7th, that was something I'll never forget. Some things are still vivid to me today that I wish weren't, but you just have to get over it and go on.
After the war, Don Thomas left the military in 1947 and made it home just in time for the birth of his son. He went on to serve for 25 years in the Detroit Police Department. The effects of being part of any war, but particularly this surprise attack, would stay with soldiers throughout their lifetime. Dr. Boland, this is a different generation, one in which post-traumatic stress disorder wasn't really recognized. In your work with Spirit of 45 and talking with these veterans, have you come into contact with many of them who are now more willing to talk about this?
Yeah, it's for a long time. Remember, when this generation came back, they were very private. You know, they were not interested in telling their stories. They came back, got to work, raised their families. And consequently, these stories are never shared with their children. So as they began to get older, people began asking questions, and they felt like that it was they shouldn't tell. But bit by bit, people have began sharing the story. And what I tell them is you can let Hollywood tell it or you can tell it. And so now they're beginning to understand, A, the importance of it, B, but on some level, the cathartic experience, because they hold on to that. And then when they share it with someone, we had an Apache Indian who was part of the Code Talkers, spoke at a national convention. And after he talked about it, which was the first time in public, he just felt like a weight was lifted off of his shoulder. And so when these guys get together, they're more willing to share. But to put it on tape, they haven't been. But we see now with the Library of Congress and the Veterans History Project that more and more veterans are willing to share it because it's how we get firsthand accurate information.
Well, these are really important stories, and we're losing these veterans. They're getting older, and
yeah.
I'm grateful that I was able to get my grandfather to finally talk about the war before he passed away. So, I mean, I heard some stories from him that I know he hadn't told anybody before.
It's the modesty of these men. It's like they didn't do anything. They just did their job, and that's how they looked at it. It's my job. They wanted to get in, get it done, and they wanted to get home.
And forget it.
Which they never really do.
Yeah.
It always, and even when I talk to, like, Pappy Wagner from Iwo Jima, he'll say it's just like it was yesterday. My husband, who was a POW in Vietnam, can recount those things. You never really lose it. You find ways to deal with it.
Or bury it, yeah.
Or bury it, right.
Yeah. Well, John Gideon, who we heard from before, talked a little bit about what it was like. It was called shell shock back then. Doctors at the time had a hard time identifying it. Let's hear more from him about that.
I started to pass out for no reason or other. And then I got, like, seizures, and they didn't understand what it was, and they was flying me back to the hospital. They couldn't find I'd be all right, and they sent me back. The third time that I come back, they decided that discharge. They took x-rays, you know, and all kinds of tests. So they put me in a special ward. I had been shocked. Being out to what I was in doing in there, I got shocked. I didn't know that, especially when I got banged out of the gig into the water and that. That affected me, so they say. Then finally they give me a medical discharge. And then I've been in a VA hospital in and out for years, and I'm still in now.
The take on post-traumatic stress disorder, it was called shell shock back then.
Jerry Yellen, who was the last pilot to fly a combat mission in World War II, also suffered from what we now know as PTSD. And finally, at age 54, he found a way to deal with it through transcendental meditation. He's now 93, and he speaks around the country a lot to these younger veterans about to remove the shame and the stigma that goes with it, of not saying you can't handle something. You know, some of these things they see, it's just hard. You just can't erase it. Everybody has their own coping mechanism, and so still, even World War II veterans have it. We now are working with some providing scholarships for transcendental meditation and different groups around. But it stays with you in ways that, and everybody has their own coping thing to do. And God bless this man who keeps going in and out. And you never know post-traumatic stress. I mean, it's after you come out and you think you've dealt with it. Well, it might not affect you till years later.
Yeah, if you have an effective way of burying it for a while, but something can always mm-hmm. just bring it up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the take on post-traumatic stress was completely different back then, as was the general domestic situation here in America. A draft had been enacted in 1940, but after the attack on U.S. soil, hundreds of thousands of Americans rushed to enlist in the armed services. We'll hear from them in just a bit. We'll also hear from one woman who talks about the support civilians provided here at home while the war was raging on. As young men and women rose to their patriotic duty, every aspect of American culture was affected. Musically, Count Basie was inspired to record the Draftin' Blues. Here's the music that was playing on the old Zenith Tube radios during the early 1940s. We'll be right back.
loving man. You better love him while you can. Perhaps you'll have to do his share to help defend this dear old land. They're drafting many men right now to give democracy a hand. Before they call your man, I'll say these words you ought to understand. When Uncle Sam calls out your man, don't sigh, don't cry, because you know he can't refuse.
Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. We are remembering Pearl Harbor today, the 75th anniversary of the attack. Maybe you or a family member was there. Call in to Gulf Coast Live and share your story. You can call us at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. You can also reach out on Facebook, WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU. Tweet us using the hashtag GCL. Today we're listening to some of our local veterans tell their stories about Pearl Harbor and World War II. We're also joined in the studio by Dr. Lois Bolin, who is a historian and works with the Spirit of 45, a group that brings veterans together to make connections and preserves these vital memories. In your role as a World War II historian, can you tell me a little bit more about the use of Florida as a training ground?
Yes. Well, as I said, in 1941, when Pearl Harbor hit, there were basically 8 training grounds. By the end of 1942, there were over 200. And if we just look in our little neck of the woods here, Buckingham was a major training base. Naples was a sub base for Buckingham. Immokalee was also a sub base for Arcadia. And so they were training pilots, gunners, engineers. And then you go on up the road between Tampa, Jacksonville, Eglin. Really, if you take a chance to look at the Florida's World War II Heritage Trail, there's over 150 sites in 72 cities around the entire state of Florida. It's the only state that has a World War II Heritage Trail, although the state of Virginia is getting ready to launch their own. After we spoke with the National Convention, they thought, what a great idea. So that gives you sort of a magnitude of, when you think of 200 training bases, that means the influx of people who came in.
Yeah, these weren't just Americans training here.
No. We had people from the Royal Air Force Academy, the base, the pilots who came here. And as we were talking early, that are currently still buried in Arcadia. It's a large number. Last year, at the 70th anniversary of World War II, we had the Consulate General from England who was here to thank America for what we did. And he took time to visit those bases and wanted to catalog that to make sure that England never forgot these men who were over here as well.
Yeah, in Arcadia there's a graveyard, and I think there are 23
right.
British young soldiers who were, I think, 20 and younger
yeah.
that are interred there, and many of them were killed when they were training in our area.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to note, I wouldn't have thought of it, but you can't train over a war-torn country.
No. No, you come here to train, and believe me, their training lasted a few weeks. It's not like it was in the Air Force now where you have a couple of years. You were put in a plane, basically given some information, you were good to go, and boom, and then you were off.
I read something somewhere about the barrier islands being used as target practice.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How did were people not living there?
They weren't living there. Anywhere that was off in the area, in the desert, there were places where people weren't there. They could use for different parts of over in Arizona and so forth. But if there weren't people there, they had to have places where they could practice to see how accurate they were and to test certain systems. So,
yeah. And I think flight was fairly new. Also.
Oh, yes, yeah.
So, I mean, there weren't a whole lot of pilots running around, too.
And when you see those planes up close and you look at them, you just think, oh, my gosh, how did they do it? And like Jimmy Doolittle, for his raid over Tokyo less than 6 months after Pearl Harbor in April, that was a major undertaking. And America really had not looked at pilots or as an Air Force in terms of dealing with war. So for Doolittle to come in, and his idea was the biggest morale builder for America, because Tokyo, Japan thought they were untouchable.
Well, I'm not familiar with his story. Who is this?
Jimmy Doolittle? Oh, my gosh. Yeah, he trained in Florida. That's really cool. So you have to look him up on that. Well, they took B-52 bombers, just took everything at them, and their goal was to go bomb Tokyo. And they're like, oh, my gosh, how are we going to do this? Well, they figured out they were just going to empty it up and put it on a carrier and take it, and they were going to have just enough fuel to launch and hope that they could make it to China, which was friendly at that time. April the 18th of 1942, the fact that America could land on Japanese soil and actually drop some bombs, they did capture some made it to China, some made it to Russia. That was the biggest morale builder for America, and it deflated to some degree, to a lot of degree, Japan, who thought they were infallible, which gave then Midway, which was 2 months later, June of 42, the Battle of Midway was another huge morale builder. So Jimmy Doolittle, he is the man's man for what he did. And building up the morale of America by doing something that no one ever thought they could do.
And he trained right here in Florida.
Trained right here in Florida, as did the guys who invaded Normandy. They trained up at Eglin and over at Fort Pierce, because you had these sandy beaches and how they would land the Higgins boats and so forth. And you don't have these cliffs you have to scale. But they had to have a place to practice, and that's what they did here.
That morale boosting and that can-do attitude is one of those things about this generation that so many generations since have come to admire so greatly. Can you tell me a little bit about some of these people that when they heard about Pearl Harbor, I know you've met many of them, mm-hmm. they rushed to get into the armed forces?
Immediately. One story that always comes to mind is a little lady who I say little lady, bless her heart, she's passed on now, but she wanted to be a nurse, but she had to weigh a certain amount. You had to weigh 100 pounds to enlist in the Army. So she tried twice, couldn't, so she got the idea. She sewed rocks in the hems of her skirt. So when she went to weigh in, that she weighed enough to be there. When these kids, and I say kids because a lot were like 17, they were too young. They lied about their age to get in to join.
Yeah, I know my grandpa did that.
Yeah. Because they were going, there's that American spirit of like, you hit my family, so we have to come back to hit you. So there was a big surge of people, not only as people joining, but the home front workers. You know, women were called upon to do certain things. We have many Rosie the Riveters that live in this area, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah,
thinking what they did.
It is, the evidence of this patriotism is huge in the number of people that it was hundreds of thousands voluntarily rushing to go get into the military. We talked with one of these people, Vernon Sigot. He's a 92-year-old veteran who's now living in Cape Coral. He was living in the small farm town of Remington, Indiana, back in 1941. His story begins when he first heard about the attack on Pearl Harbor on the radio.
When Pearl Harbor was attacked, I was out hunting. When I got in, my mother said Pearl Harbor was just bombed by Japanese. I said, where's Pearl Harbor? And she said, that's Hawaii. Really couldn't believe it happened, but immediately the feeling, well, we've got to do something. It was more or less of a mass enlistment or volunteering to be drafted or to go to service or signing up. The attitude of the whole country just completely changed after that. I was a senior in high school at the time and 17 years old. Well, my brother was 6 years older than me, and he immediately signed up or volunteered. And then when I was 18, I had to sign up for the draft. And I thought, well, I'm going to go to college, see what happens. In the meantime, I took my physical and mental for Army Air Corps cadets. I was taken into Army Air Corps in April of 43. From there, I went to cadet training for navigation. After that, I was assigned to B-17s, went over to Italy, flew 32 sorties over German territory. When the war was over, I actually was scheduled for the 33rd sortie, the CO came in and said, the war is over, mission is scrubbed. But I stayed in Italy with the occupational force. After the war, I came home, signed up for reserves. I was finance officer and procurement officer, and retired in 1969 as a lieutenant colonel. I consider myself very blessed and fortunate and lucky to have survived combat. I can truthfully say I was awfully scared at times and got knocked on my can a couple of times with flak coming through the fuselage of the B-17. Knowing I had to fly through all that flak bursting in front of us, needless to say, I said lots of prayers, and I'm very fortunate to be here.
That is Vernon Sigo. He's 92 years old, lives in Cape Coral. He says he had he not signed up for the reserves, he would have likely been deployed to Korea or Vietnam. We are remembering Pearl Harbor today, the 75th anniversary of that attack. Maybe you or a family member was there. Call in to Gulf Coast Live and share your story. You can call us at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. You can also reach out on Facebook, WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU. Tweet us using the hashtag GCL. While many people did run to enlist, there were support efforts that quickly began across the country and here in Florida. Getting raw materials together, building boats, war equipment, demand for timber soared in response to this war effort. And here, the Tamiami Trail, as you had mentioned before, has officially opened in 1926.
28.
That created kind of a lifeline to the Big Cypress
Mm-hmm.
Basin.
Takahatchee Strand.
Yeah. So tell me how that had an impact, just pulling out cypress trees.
Well, those were big cypress trees. They weren't pulling out. They were used for boat building and for various and sundry materials. So it was a very significant area. As I said, it was the final frontier of Florida. So they used that for their shipbuilding and so forth. What a lot of people don't know is the anti-venom for snakes. There were, I think it's Esplanade, if I can remember his name. He was the brother-in-law of Eddie Frank, Bubba Frank, sorry, who invented the swamp buggy. And they used that anti-venom serum during the war for people who were in the Philippines or whatever. They'd be bitten with snakes. They would use that as a counter-venom, active venom for that.
So the serum was something that came from?
From the Everglades.
Oh.
Yeah, they had to milk the snakes to get the venom from the snakes that they could then send to be used for an anti-serum.
Wow.
Yeah.
So
you had the air in Southwest Florida, yeah.
And that was sent along with military troops that were going into
yes.
areas that had similar poisonous
right.
snakes. Snakes.
Because you had in the Philippines and the areas like that.
Which kind of have the same type of...
Yeah, any kind of moist area like that where there would be snakes.
Yeah, that kind of tropical
right. yeah.
situation. So.
Right.
And then what kind of impact did all that logging have on the Big Cypress area? I mean, was it a lot?
It was a lot, yeah. It's like we don't know what you don't know, and you certainly aren't going to say, oh, don't take down the trees because you're at war and that's where you need to do that.
Yeah.
And so that was Baron, the Collier family, but Baron Collier was gone by then, their contribution to do that. We also had another very interesting person here. His name was Lester Norris. Lester Norris, if you're familiar with, they were the largest Texaco stockholders, wanted to enter the war, but he was unable to do that. So he became the marketer for Victory Gardens, and they're from Naples, Southwest Florida.
Victory Gardens were huge
around the country. And so everyone had a Victory Garden. You sent you did your own vegetables. Everything that was grown was sent overseas. And so it was kind of cool to have that Mr. Norris was here and all the things he did in starting the conservancy, saving Q.A. Dylan and Delner Wiggins Pass mm-hmm. and so forth.
And the originator of the idea of the Victory Garden.
Uh-huh.
Wow. We do have a caller on the line. We have Craig calling in from Fort Myers who has a story to tell about his father. Can you tell us about him, Craig?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to share my father's story. He's 95 and still going strong, but he can't come to the phone right now. He had graduated the Merchant Marine Academy and was working on the president lines in the Pacific. And on December 6th, actually, they left Shanghai, headed for Pearl Harbor. And they get a radio message that Pearl Harbor is being attacked, and they can't go to Pearl Harbor, and they should go to Manila. And so they're pulling into Manila, and the Japanese are attacking Manila at that same time. So they turn tail and get out of there. They have to link up with all many other civilian ships to convoy all the way from the Philippines to Pearl Harbor. They ended up with one old oiler in their convoy who could only make 12 knots. So they spent days zigzagging across the Pacific at 12 knots. So they got to Pearl Harbor. He tells that when they pulled into Pearl Harbor, they loaded his ship up with burn victims from the attack, which they then took to San Francisco. And as soon as they got to San Francisco, he resigned his job with the President Lines and went in and signed up with the Navy. And he was a naval officer on a destroyer in the South Pacific through the whole war.
Wow, that is a really interesting story. He walked into it, floated into it, I guess, as a civilian.
Yeah. Exactly. Not expecting. He had been making the San Francisco, Hawaii, Guam, Shanghai run for some years, as a merchant seaman.
And they had no way to protect themselves either, right?
No, nothing at all. The only thing they could do was convoy with a bunch of people and zigzag, across the Pacific, hoping not to run into any submarines or anything like that. And then he spent the entire war on one ship, which was surprising, on a destroyer. And he had lots of tales about, being in the South Pacific on that destroyer. But
these are stories that I would encourage you to record. Telling those, because those are going to be really great things to have.
He's kind of losing his thing at 95 now, but he still remembers those. Those are pretty traumatic events and dramatic events in his life, and he remembers those pretty
well. Thanks so much for calling in. I really appreciate it. And, those are memories that don't go away. And there we have the story of a civilian. And many civilians were affected by Pearl Harbor that maybe, this man did go into the service, but we have a story now of a woman who didn't. She's 84 years old now. Her name is LaVon Doss, and she remembers hearing the news on December 7th, 1941, in her hometown of Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin.
I was a pretty small girl when I heard the story on the radio that the Japanese had just bombed Pearl Harbor. And I was so frightened, and I was listening to hear the planes come over because I thought they were going to bomb us, and because I had no idea where Pearl Harbor was. I was in a little town called Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, along the Mississippi. We thought we were going to have bombs coming on our house. We kids were sitting on the day bed, and they had the radio on. And when President Roosevelt spoke, he had a way about him that was very fatherly, I would say. And even though he was telling us things were really bad, that we were going to be okay. We all stick together, and don't be afraid. Stick together and fight together, and we'll all be okay. He had a very reassuring man. We listened to the speech, and we understood it a little bit better. By the end of the day, everyone explained, the planes aren't coming over our house. They're far away, but if things went badly, we could have that happen. We had to move back out to the farm to live with my grandmother because my uncle was going into the service as a single man. So during this war, we lived on the farm, and I remember us in our little school going out into the ravines and everything and collecting scrap metal for the war effort and buying 10-cent stamps so that we could get war bonds. My mother baked our own bread. We ate a lot of beans, sugar rationing, and if you had a car, which we had part of the time, gas was rationed. And even gas on the farm, if you had a tractor or something, gas was rationed. Things were really hard back then, but you did it for your country.
And a lot of people did. We are remembering Pearl Harbor today, the 75th anniversary of the attack. Maybe you, a family member, was there. Give us a call at Gulf Coast Live to share your story, 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. You can also reach out on Facebook, WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU. Tweet us using the hashtag GCL. She was talking about a time long ago and how things were so different and so very difficult. And this had a pretty big impact on agricultural families because the men left to go and serve in the war. So a lot of things fell on the shoulders of women who didn't enter the service.
Exactly. Not just agricultural, but building the planes, even secretarial work, which we think now is sort of normal. That was done by men. It was not done by any job that a man was doing. Women came in to fill it in. And we were talking about Victory Gardens, about when you did have to make your own food, and that's how you survived. And the rationing, I think, was the – this is something a younger generation would never understand, about you can only have so much sugar, or you can only have so much of this, because it was – It was a very hard time for people in America. But the thing that joined, that bonded them together, was this united being as one. As Roosevelt said, we'll be all right. We have to stick together as one. And everything they did was for the boys overseas.
Yeah, it seems like the theme is just suck it up. We're going to get through this.
Yeah.
All together.
It's not just hard for you. It's hard for everybody. And
yeah.
So whatever you did, Ben, people put their – you know, joined forces and did whatever it is they had to do to get by.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to minimize Pearl Harbor by any stretch, but this overwhelming patriotism, we also experienced this after another attack on our soil, which was with 9/11. And I think we have a lot of people that went into the armed services and have since come back. Do you find that in your work with veterans, some of these younger veterans are able to speak with older veterans and kind of have, I don't want to say similar experiences, but be able to kind of connect?
There's a camaraderie with anybody who's experienced war that when you are talking to a civilian, it's just different. And I can tell you from my experience and the younger veterans, younger, whether it's the Cold War or 9/11, they revere these guys. I mean, you have to think about World War II, what they went into with nothing, how they were called to – just if you look at Normandy and the wall and how they did that. So they do share a lot. They used to be Homer Helters. Everybody gets together and they share stories. I took my husband to the VA, and within like 60 seconds, there were four other Army Air Force guys. And they sat around. They just started talking. They pulled their chairs that were all in straight lines like in a doctor's office. And they were sharing stories about I did this, I did that. That's a camaraderie that from a World War II guy to a Vietnam guy, they're all can relate to that moment of being under that kind of siege.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a call coming in from Howard. He is in Cape Coral. Howard's on the line, and he has a theory that he wanted to share with us. Howard? Howard, are you there? We have lost Howard.
Oh, Howard.
Okay. Well, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about some of the events that you do with the veterans. What are mm-hmm. some of the things that you do with getting them together, and what kind of events do you have planned in the next few?
Well, let me just talk about the Spirit of 45, because it is a national event, and it was started if you remember the nurse and the kiss, Edith Shane, remember the kiss on 1945 on when they called that the war was over, the sailor, she's bending over and getting
the kiss. Oh, yes.
Okay. Well, she was a lady that inspired the Spirit of 45. And in 2010, Congress passed a resolution making the second Sunday in August the official day to honor the Greatest Generation. So around the country on that second weekend, there are breakfasts and there are different events where people are honoring the legacy of this generation. They endured the Great Depression. They defeated the greatest tyranny that the world has ever seen. And here's the great thing about those World War II generation. They went on to not only rebuild America, but the countries of their enemies. They rebuilt them as well. So we have a breakfast. Fort Myers has their Sunday dinner. We have the official thing for Spirit of 45. It's called Taps Across America. And TAP starts at sunset at the World War II Memorial. And at sunset, 1,945 buglers across the country. Naples contributes seven of those. And it ends at the Punch Bowl in Honolulu. And it's a way to join the country in a tribute to this generation and then to remembering the ending.
Mm-hmm. That's
of World War II and the legacy of and it's also
kind of like Hands Across America, but Horns Across America.
Yes, Horns Across America. And we get a lot of children involved because it's connecting the latest generation to the greatest generation. That's what it's about, to make sure that these children, and they love the stories. I mean, I've taken several. We have a couple of guys here. One was at Pearl Harbor, and one taught celestial navigation for around the state of Florida, so they could spot submarines, mm-hmm. which there were around the state of Florida. One was actually bombed off the coast of Key West. So there are lots of activities. There are so many, which Florida is now number one, or it claims itself to be number one in terms of revering its veterans. So from Southwest Florida Veterans Alliance, the Spirit of 45, Home Base, Wounded Warrior, Take a Soldier Fishing. There are lots of these things that people are reaching out to honor their veterans because –
Mm-hmm. We also have Honor Flight, too.
Honor Flight. We have stuff Honor Flight here, and then there's all over the country. And that's one of the cool things that with Spirit of 45, we sort of negotiated this thing that we were hoping that Honor Flight would then begin to capture the stories of these World War II veterans to put into the Library of Congress, the Veterans History Project. It's a natural way, too. Just like you said, you filmed recorded some of these people. Those are the stories we need to keep. And that's a great clearinghouse at the Library of Congress.
Can laypersons submit stories to the Library of Congress to preserve some of these stories?
If you go online to the Veterans History Project, they have it's a step-by-step process that you do. And you don't have to be fancy with it because they want it unedited. Because they want it pure, they don't want any tampering with it. So you can do it. You can film it or you can just tape record it. And they have a series of questions and all the forms we have to sign off on. And you send it in. So it's a great thing for a family member to do, anyone that has an opportunity to do. And believe me, like I said, Ken Burns, who did his story, his documentary called War, a lot of his research came from there. And due to their search words, they were able to find a person that was maybe with another person in same, and they didn't know they were together, and so they could put some of those stories together from that research.
That is really a couple different perspectives on the same thing.
Yes.
All right. Well, I think that we have Howard back on the line from Cape Coral. Howard, are you there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay. What was it that you wanted to ask?
Yeah, basically, I missed the first part of your show, but I believe there's some indications that the U.S. government and the British government had information that this attack was coming. We had an ambassador, Joseph Gru, in Japan, and he passed along back in January of 41 rumors that he heard from the Peruvian ambassador that the attack was going to be coming against Pearl Harbor. Also, I once read a book entitled something like 3 Days to Pearl, and it was written by a British airman in Indonesia who had been in a bar, and he heard a Japanese worker talking about the fact that this Japanese worker had been working in a torpedo factory to modify torpedoes to run in shallow water. So I believe that our government had some information that this attack was coming, but that's about all I wanted to, the point I wanted to make.
Well, that's interesting. I hadn't heard that. Had you heard that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And one of, there's a documentary out that it was just on the History Channel. Part of the reason is, could be a lot of reasons, but my hypothesis is at that time there were fiefdoms within different departments. And so if you would share a piece of information with one department, they wouldn't necessarily share it with another piece of information with another department. And so they had this information, but they weren't connecting the dots. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't share the same piece of paper. They couldn't get together in a room then. Oops, hello. but yes, and part of what he's saying, did they know? They did know. I don't think they connected the dots. I don't think they would let 2,400 people be killed. But his point is taken that there is concern that there was information out, but they didn't have a system in place to synthesize all that. And and just
the kind of hindsight, like hindsight is 20/20 kind of situation.
Pearl Harbor got the information there was going to be an attack 8 hours after the attack had already occurred. I mean, that was, you're just sitting here going, how could this happen? And you're right, how could we not put all these dots together? And it just was the way centralization of power was at that time.
Have you ever heard a veteran react to these types of questions and the second guessing? Or have you, how do veterans seem to view these types of?
Well, it happened. And hopefully they can correct what happened. Do they go back and lament, and are they mad about it? You know, it's kind of late for that. But I think as we now look at history again, because now information has been released where it does show that information was there. And there were two commanding officers that were blamed for this, which they had no power. They had no information to do this, and they still were trying to they're still trying to get them reinstated back to get their 4 stars. It's just like with USS Indianapolis when it was blown up.
It's kind of hard to look back and
you can look back
things,
and see, but in theory, but you can learn from it. So I appreciate his question, and he's right. I think there was information. The way it was, power was fiefdoms. They didn't have a way to
that just hadn't connected
the dots.
Like you said.
Yeah.
Well, what I found most interesting is the impact that Florida had being used as a training ground. And Buckingham, which is now mosquito control.
Right.
So interesting. I really appreciate you coming in, Dr. Bolin. We're going to have to leave it there for our conversation on Pearl Harbor today, the 75th anniversary of the Japanese attack on the Hawaiian Naval Base. I'd like to thank you so much for coming in, for sharing your insight into Florida's World War II heritage. Our show today was produced by Matthew Smith with technical help from A.J. Leonard and John Davis. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. A special thanks to WGCU intern Michael Hirsch, who recorded the interviews that you heard today from the Pearl Harbor survivors and vets. And an additional thanks to Ralph Santillo with Cape Coral Southwest Florida Military Museum and Library. Every Tuesday, the museum offers a free lunch for veterans, their spouses, and widows. That lunch gave us an opportunity to meet some of the veterans that you heard from today. If you want to hear extended interviews with some of the veterans, you can find them online at WGCUnews.org. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. Tomorrow on the show, global warming is an inevitable reality, according to scientists. Sea levels are predicted to rise up to 6 inches in the next 50 years. Tomorrow, we'll talk with the people who are making plans to deal with that in the Estero Bay, ahead of a conference on the subject scheduled for this weekend. Also, is your house cat a predator? Conservationists say that the unmutable hunting instinct is taking out billions of birds every year. We'll talk about Fluffy's propensity to hunt and other little-known impacts on wildlife. Thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO, Mark Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.
So, Chattanooga, choo-choo.
Won't you choo-choo me home?
Chattanooga, Chattanooga.
All aboard.
Chattanooga, Chattanooga.
Get aboard.
Chattanooga, Chattanooga. Chattanooga, choo-choo.
Won't you choo-choo me home?
Chattanooga, choo-choo.